Soul Talk is a podcast dedicated to making space for Latinx storytellers and content creators across all media to chat about their art, experiences, and culture. As a branch of the Soul Project, Soul Talk welcomes you to the Green Room.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Soul Talk. My name is Joey Reyes. I'm the producing assistant with the Soul Project, and I'm joined again.
Hi, my name is David Mendizabal. I'm the associate artistic director of the Soul Project. And on today's episode, we're going to be chatting with Victor Vasquez and Brian Herrera about the history of casting practices, thinking about challenging the ways in which we think about casting and, mm-hmm. and thinking about more equitable, inclusive, and safe spaces for our artists, specifically Latinx and artists of colors, to do their best work and get seen. Victor Vasquez serves as the casting director and line producer, and he's a member of the artistic team at Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. Previous employment includes working at Center Theater Group, Pasadena Playhouse, Cornerstone Theater Company. He is a recipient of writing fellowships from Pen America and Lambda Literary as an emerging LGBTQ writer. He is a master's candidate in dramatic writing at the University of Oxford. So he is bouncing around between DC, here with us in New York, and London or Oxford. He is the son of Mexican immigrants. Spanish is his native language. And he is originally from Los Angeles. So we're excited to have him here with us.
Yes. And like David said, we're also going to have Brian Herrera, who is our resident scholar with the Soul Project, a writer, a teacher, teaches at Princeton University. He's the author of the Latinx Theater Commons 2013 National Convening, a narrative report, came out in 2015 through HowlRound. His book, Latinx Numbers, Playing Latino in the 20th Century U.S. Popular Performance, came out in 2015 and was awarded the George Jean Nathan Award for Dramatic Criticism and received an honorable mention for the John W. Frick Book Award from the American Theater and Drama Society. He will be talking a little bit about his upcoming book. It was previously called Casting a History. But he does mention that the title did change to Next. And so that'll be coming out soon as well. So that's just our brief overview of our two guests for today. But of course, they'll be diving in a little bit deeper. But we're looking forward to talking with them about, again, this reciprocity of scholarship and practice and how those intertwine in the industry, particularly within casting. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, get a little first listen, a sneak peek on Brian's new book.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So we'll be right back with our two guests. Don't go anywhere. Welcome, Brian and Victor, to Soul Talk.
Hi.
Thank you guys so much for being here.
Thank you.
So we're here talking about casting and I guess the history of casting, where we are right now and casting Latinx people and Latinx identified roles and in non-traditional ways. And Brian, as the Soul Project's resident scholar and a writer and a scholar on casting, your book Latin Numbers. For those of us who have read it, we know more about it. But for those of us listening who haven't, if you can give us a brief overview of what you were exploring in that book and your relationship to casting and that knowledge.
Yeah. So Latin Numbers is a book that came out in 2015, and it is a book that I was developing for a good while. And it was really thinking about the presence and absence mm-hmm. of not only Latinx identified performers, but also Latinx characters, which we know are not always played by Latinx performers, and also Latinx narratives. And I was interested in a historical story of how the story I often tell is that in 1999, those of you who are around might remember that it was the summer that everyone suddenly was living La Vida Loca. and then there was this summer where it was like Time and Newsweek and New York Magazine, all when print magazines were a big deal. They all led with covers about the importance of Latino influence in culture. Mm-hmm. And I was just old enough, and everybody was talking about this Latin explosion. There was J-Lo, there was Mark Anthony, there was all these different people, and they were talking about the Latin explosion everywhere. And I was like, I was just old enough that I remembered, haven't Latinos exploded before?
Right.
And so I thought, like, okay, yeah, 87, and I remember in the late 70s. And I sort of, as a historian, I started tracking back, and I realized that there was this cycle of discovery and erasure mm-hmm. of Latinx culture, and performers in particular became sort of a hot topic in right. different eras. And I can track it trace it back to the mid-19th century, but the book really looks from the late 1930s up until the turn to this millennium and looks at these cycles of the place where I can see the presence or impact or influence of Latinx performers or narratives or stories and what was going on at the moment that they came and what aspects of performance mattered. Like, was it the genre, the story? Was it what happened in the 70s when Latinx folks began telling their own stories in ways that are legible on a mainstream level? And at the center of that book is a chapter called Stealth Latinos, where I knew there was a story I wanted to tell about the peculiar historical fact that between 1946 and 1963, more Latino performers were nominated for and won Academy Awards than any period before or since.
Wow.
I'll say that again. More Latino actors were recognized by the Academy Awards between 1946 and 1963.
Wow.
This is not necessarily a period we think of as a golden age of Latinx representation. And so I was fascinated by this paradox. These are folks like Jose Ferrer and Rita Moreno, Katie Jurado, Anthony Quinn. And so I decided to look at them. And then I began to realize when I looked at the next level of actors, actors who are seriously working actors but not nominated actors, the phenomenon continued where Latino actors got a lot of work, but they also got a lot of work only occasionally playing Latinx identified or Latin American stories. They were often playing characters of African descent or of indigenous descent or of Asian descent. And so I knew there was a story to be told about the way Latinx bodies were used in this period in film. And I saw this pattern going on in film, television, and theater. So I said, there's something going on, but how do I tell this story? And that led me to what is my current interest, which is the history of casting.
Right.
Because as I was working on the Stealth Latinos chapter, I was kept going to the library looking for a book on the history of the material practices of casting. And I kept coming up dry. Like, there was not a book there. And over the years, I kept going back and I kept going back and I kept going back. And every time, like when you go to the library, whether digitally or actually, you'll end up finding something right next to what you were looking for.
Right.
And I would hold on to those things. And suddenly I began to realize that amidst those fragments, I was beginning to see a story. And so that led to my current book project, which is newsflash, I have a new title. It's called Next, A Brief History of Casting.
Wow.
And it's a story of how the material practices of casting have evolved from the late 19th century into the early 21st century. This sort of the ways in which casting as a practice, which, of course, for millennia, actors have found their ways to roles, have been assigned roles. But there's something that happens when industrial capitalism discovers entertainment as an industry in the late 19th century that begins moving from actors joining companies or being part of families or being part of troops to suddenly actors playing as cast, to being hired to play particular roles. And that leads to practices that weren't around before 100 or so years ago. Things like the audition.
Right.
Things like the casting profession. Things like breakdowns.
Right.
Like, these things were not necessarily necessary features of putting on shows, and they have over the last 100 years. So my book attempts, in a general overarching way, to give a sense of where the breakdown came from, where the audition came from, where the casting director came from. And it's all guided by my investment in, again, the presence and absence of Latinx folks on the stage. And then more broadly, the way that casting is always a glimpse into the operation of power. And so for me, those two things guide my interest in terms of how can we look at casting, which often gets a lot of attention, but rarely a lot of sophisticated analysis.
Right.
We often end up in the same cul-de-sacs of conversation. We end up at the same dead ends whenever we talk about casting. And so I'm trying to figure out how can we have a more rigorous conversation about casting. And as a historian, I say history can help us get more rigor to the work we want to do as we want to make. If we want to make changes or if we want to advocate more effectively, history sometimes can provide us productive tools.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. And, you know, we're so excited to have you here having this conversation and also to be here partner with Victor Vasquez, who is the casting director at the Arena Stage. And Victor, I guess a question to start you off is, how does one get into casting, and how aware were you or of some of these historical processes before and now that you are a part of that world?
So I love all the stuff that you just said, Brian, because, you know, I was handed the tradition of casting from Amelia Costa Pau, right, who was the casting director before me at Arena Stage. was there for about four or five years. And before her was Dan Personical, also a person of color, of Asian descent. And so Dan, who handed the sort of seat to Amelia, then that seat was handed to me. You know, this history for me exists through them. And it's a sort of like handoff, right? And you're right. I also have not been able to locate or find, you know, why is this the tradition of this form? Because I came into it. So, you know, I'm from the West Coast. I'm from Los Angeles. I sure studied theater, directing, writing. I found myself working artistically, mostly as a producer, really, like programming work and managing programs. And did casting in within that and then got my job at Arena Stage, right? So it was sort of like, sure, I acquired a lot of the skill sets, which then allowed me to step into this office. But I came in with a lot of questions. I was very like skeptical about this whole tradition. You know, maybe because I'm just skeptical about everything. Because, you know, it's like first generation American, my parents are from Mexico. It's like English is not even my first language. And so I walk in the world and I go, why?
Yeah.
Why
yeah.
why do we do it this way? And why was there a couch? Why do we have a table?
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of these questions right now that I'm still sort of, you know, offering up in a sort of brain trust way to even actors who are in the room with me. And I'm like, hey, what does it look like for you to walk into a casting room without a table?
Right.
What does it look like for you to, you know, for a director and a casting director to engage with you as if it's a rehearsal room, as if we're all standing? There are a few, like, you know, elevated tables that are small enough to put your coffee, but that the square, the space is adaptive.
Yeah.
And so I've come to this seat with ambivalence, with skepticism, with a lot of questions that I feel like I can't answer, or maybe I just have to invent. And so I love this, the fact that we are exploring the history and we are determining where, what historically, why does this exist this way? Because I think, as is the title of your book next, I would like to pose what also comes next after today, right now in this day and age, right? So let me answer your question, after processing what Brian, the brilliance Brian just, you know, shared on the table. What was your question? Remind me.
How you got into it? How you got into casting? And I, you know, you answered the second part first. So
sure.
The first part was how you got there.
You know, it's a long-winded story. And I think, you know, I started off at Center Theater Group working in education and community partnerships. I then started working at Pasadena Playhouse in their artistic department. I worked there for about 2.5 years under Sheldon Epps right before he retired after 20 years. He was a black man. He's a black man artistic director in the West Coast. And so I existed under an artistic leadership that already was unpacking what the American theater meant. And so for me at the time, the assignment for those 2.5 years was an Irvine Foundation grant that really gave me the liberty to create artistic programming for adult Latinx adults within the LA San Gabriel Valley. And so a lot of the stuff I was able to do was produce a lot of readings and workshops, work on the development of a new musical with a band named Ozomatli, who's LA based, work with a lot of the directors and writers locally, and program with community at the intersection of artistic programming. And so I did that, and there was a lot of sort of contractual work, you know, a lot of the general management stuff and paper casting and you're casting readings and et cetera, et cetera. And also we were able to put on a show of Real Women Have Curves on the stage that was in L.A. on that stage, Pasadena Playhouse. It was the first time in 10 years since we had a Latinx lead character on that stage. And so to be able to do the work and then get a person, a Latinx person as a lead, or really it was a story about, I think, 5 or 6 women, Latinx women, and written by Josefina Lopez, a Latinx writer. And so that really sort of gave me the holistic understanding of, you know, artistic programming, artistic building, artistic management, that sort of gave me the tool sets to then get a call from Arena Stage and be like, hey, would you like to step into this job? I went to go eat a burrito and I decided to leave Los Angeles and I came over And I stepped into it, and Amelia and I had a crossover about 2 weeks where she was like saying, like, you know, this is how I do this job, but I give it to you. I hand it off now.
Right.
And so a lot of that stuff that I've been able to like then sort of take ownership of this casting office, but really also investigate the systems at play. Yeah. And what you're talking about, power, is innate to the DNA of casting.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to take that out. And I don't know how to, right. Because it is attached to the umbilical cord of theater.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and the theater is an art form of power.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I do think the reason I was wanting to jump in a little bit there was I think, I don't know, because power is at the core of so much theater, taking it out may or may not be, I wonder about that, but I also think revealing it's transparent, making it transparent, like that is where the intervention can be, is how can we disrupt our choice to sort of make sure that power remains invisible, like power's operation remains invisible, that you have to sort of learn it by code or by secret whisper. Mm. Like how can you dismantle its right. concealment so it can operate us? Because fundamentally, casting, I firmly believe that casting, one of the reasons it is so interesting to me is it's always an allocation of resources.
Right.
It's always simultaneously a creative act. It's an interpretive act. It's sort of manifesting a work on a stage, but it's also an allocation of resources, which is in some ways like you're giving somebody a job, you're giving somebody visibility, you're giving somebody network, you're giving somebody yeah. context. When you decide that of these 27 amazing actors, the 28th is the one that gets the opportunity, that right. involves an allocation of resources. So there is an aspect of power operation in there, but how are you holding that power is mm-hmm. I think what's so powerful yeah. about what Amelia said is I'm giving you this role, but I'm letting you, I'm showing it to you and I'm letting you to take it rather than saying we have to preserve it, we have to conceal it, we, you know, and I think everything you've named, like shifting the table, I have a whole, I can talk for hours about the tradition of the table, but one thing I'd love for you to name, Victor, if you could, is you use the term paper casting. Could you define that term?
Sure. So every casting director will create a list mm-hmm. for, you know, characters, character tracking within a script. Paper casting is when you can offer up a list to a director and say, these are the top five recommendations I make based on the script I just read.
Mm-hmm.
And here are the headshots and resumes. And we can paper cast, meaning we will cast without seeing the person live.
Great. Mm-hmm. No, I think that's useful because I think so much when we think about casting as being in a room with a table or sure, with yeah. a door or with somebody outside saying next, or increasingly we're thinking about self-taping, self-submission.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I do think that it's also worth noting that a key aspect of about how a lot of things are actually cast operate in sort of a different mode, which is not necessarily the actor's not even necessarily even in the room or in the conversation yet. Mm-hmm. And I think part of what I appreciate about you saying, like, I'd love for there to be a space where an actor can come in and have a table on which they can put their coffee, that is a casting process that is thinking about the actor as a human, as yeah. a presence, as opposed to somebody who's got 3 minutes to show what they can do.
Expendable.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's really about decentralizing that yeah. power, right? Yeah. I like that you say that it's important to call it out.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then for me, what's important after that is to decentralize it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I do think that that's the real opportunity that
yeah.
I often, when I speak in educational context, I say there are times when we have the habits of casting that we receive, the practices that we're familiar with, and we often think, but that's how it has to do. That's what's right. done in the industry. There's all kinds of ways where you can change how you do it.
Absolutely.
And if you're directing mm-hmm. a show, you can not follow those rules.
Absolutely.
Like, but if you don't know the rules, if you're still figuring them out, it's hard to know. So hopefully, like, between this kind of revealing what the rules are, there's yeah. opportunities, sort of, this is the places of intervention, too.
Absolutely. And one thing, I mean, you know, we were talking recently with Maria Gayanis, and she was talking about how you can, you know, see a person's values in their budget. And mm-hmm. as you're talking about casting, it makes me think about you can see a person's values in yep. how they cast a show. And I think especially in this moment in time where we are so focused in the American theater, rightfully so, sometimes I think in the wrong ways, about this idea of representation and thinking about that for Latinx identified stories yep. specifically. Yep. And also stories where race or ethnicity, it could be anyone. I'm curious to know from both of you, either historically or in your current practice, where have you seen places where those values can be upheld, or values that you carry into the room as a casting director, or values that you have? Where have you seen those upheld? Where do you see the sort of pushback in that sort of thing?
It's a good question. And I think it's because when we're looking at casting, we're looking at evidence of a practice. It's almost like evidence of rehearsal. Like, how can you see? Sometimes you can see a show and you feel like I can almost get a sense of how the show was rehearsed. But it's very much like I don't have any data for that. And often casting is like, how do we know how they got the part? Like, often when I started doing the history of casting, people were saying, well, how will you know?
Right.
And I said, well, we can see, we can see practices and patterns and evidence. And I think one of the things that is a really interesting question when we look at how Latinx actors in particular have maneuvered the hidden curriculum of casting is often in things like how they have centered or decentered their Latinx identity in their bios, the ways in which they have often at the earliest phases of their career been counseled out of like dropping their surname and going with their first and middle name.
Straightening their hair.
You know, and these kinds, and often, but often these consequential decisions, like your hair can grow out, you can change your color, you can go back. But when you register for Actors Equity under a certain name and you dropped your legibly Latinx surname from that, then you carry that choice with you through your career.
Absolutely.
Likewise, like I'm fascinated by I recently had a student who came after seeing a show that's currently on Broadway, outraged by a joke in the second act, which was hype, which was a Latin number, like this heightened Latin inflected style. And the student was outraged that the performer was not Latinx. And I was like, and I heard the performer's name and I said, I need to check because maybe. Right. And sure enough, this is a performer who is of Latinx descent, but is multicultural, and their surname is not legibly Latinx, and nor is their professional biography.
Right.
Like, it's not full of West Side Story and In the Heights, and like, it's not, you know, they've sort of, and it's not like they've been closeted about their Latinxness, but they also haven't led with it.
Right.
And I think for actors who are maneuvering the temptations of white privilege, that can be very complicated, just as for folks who, because casting really likes to sort people by gender, male or female, by race, often white or black or what. And so often folks, when they're trying to gain access to the most opportunity for employment, they're often been encouraged or feel pressure or just make the choice to prioritize an aspect of themselves that may lead to the lack of less legibility for their Latinxness.
Right.
And so that's the thing I think I see the most is watching actors maneuver the complexity of of a practice casting, which doesn't really isn't always looking like you run the risk of like are you this or are you that or you're neither. You go in the extra pile and they don't go back to you.
Right.
You know, so how are you legible enough?
And ethnically ambiguous.
And that's the fraught history of that term.
Yeah.
Right. Mm. And indeed, the period I looked at in Studies Latinos was a period when ethnic ambiguity and the argument I make in the book is that these actors were clearly racial, but were not clearly what kind of racial. So they could be all kinds of race.
Absolutely.
And so there's times in which that's an attribute. There's times when that's a liability. Mm-hmm. And so Latinx actors are always struggling with legibility. Are they only Latinx? Can they play? What? And that's every marked actor, whether it's based on gender or ability or race, is always maneuvering that thing of if I lead with my identity in a way that feels empowered, is that going to limit my opportunity? And so you see the strategic choices of actors in all kinds of evidence that you can see in the often I look at their biographies as much as I look at the roles they get, you know, like or the roles that they're I'm seeing right now. I track back. But I totally agree with you and Maria that production values need to start including like how do we see the values of a production in how they allocate resources to things like casting or things like dialect coaching, like what are they investing in, especially with regard to Latinxness?
Absolutely.
It's interesting that you mention actors having this like struggle of understanding, you know, how they fit within Latinx identity. This is a common conversation that keeps coming up in even the last two episodes of what that identity even means. And I think people were ourselves and then people outside of the community are spending like a lot of time trying to define what that means when there's just like this, it's not a monolith. There's such a plethora of cultures and backgrounds, and you know, with the effects of the slave trade and colonization, and like it's formed into something that's just so vast and so diverse. And I think we just I personally like want to lean more into that and like just like get to on the individual level of like what is someone's background. But it is hard when there's a lot of like this siloing going on.
And I think what you're saying is spot on, Joey, because it's the story of intersectionality.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right. Is that Latinidad can also be intersectional with Filipino, you know, or Afro-Latinx, or
Jewish,
Chinese Latinos. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. Yes, right? The diaspora is one that is not a monolith, as you said. And I want to go back to this conversation too, just what you were mentioning, Brian, and sort of explode that open, really, and talk about, you know, like Rachel Shafkin, who just, you know, gave that speech at the Tonys and talked about the theater having an imagination problem. Mm-hmm. And I so love that metaphor because for me, it is an imagination problem because representation happens because who we have to ask who is representing, who is, as we were talking about power, who has the power to share that power of what who gets to represent what, right?
Yeah.
And it's the power of who's imagining what's on stage.
Right.
It's the scaffolding of directors and playwrights and executives and artistic directors and board members is that the actor cannot be represented without the ecosystem being representational as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this is call for an imagination, expansive imagination that can include us all, as you say, Joey, in an intersectional, healthy, vibrant way, can only happen, in my opinion, if we are considering that adaptive ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
Within the American theater.
Absolutely.
I have a lot to say about this topic as I scroll through my notes. I also just want to say that in order for me to even advocate for the imagination to be more expansive, there needs to be a conversation about undoing racism within that as well.
Yeah.
And for me, that is a hard conversation that I feel a lot of us are pressed to have. But not everybody's at the table,
right.
And we're not really calling it out. And so, you know, I think about casting, but I also think about white supremacy in casting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think about white supremacy in the American theater. I think about racism in the American theater and in casting. And as I've inherited this seat, I look at some of these systems in play and I go, wow, this is not healthy.
Well, and one of the core threads of casting that I think is always the problem is so white supremacist, right? Because it's all about expediency and efficiency. And talk about why, so, you know, like this, like what category do you fit? We got to have a quick list. We got to do this quickly. We only have 2 weeks to cast. We only have these 2 days where we have this number of slots. This pressure on expediency and efficiency is peak white supremacy to me, peak white supremacist structure and thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's like, you know, it's a broken system.
Yeah.
And my question as we move forward is, how do we heal that system and how do we reinvent it?
Yeah.
Well, one thing I would say, I would just encourage folks to sort of, whenever you start pulling up, I was thinking about the word authenticity, right? And we'll often hear folks call for more authentic casting.
Mm-hmm.
Or more culturally literate casting, or those kind of things. And so one thing I think that we can be very attentive to is, what are we asking bodies, especially vulnerable bodies of actors, because all actors' bodies are vulnerable in different ways in this industry. And so what work are we asking them to do to also perform authenticity, and how does that then end up limiting certain things? And that can be, I think, one of the ways that within Latinx communities of advocacy, I think if we look at the media broadly, the Latinx media broadly, there's only recently has there been an interest and investment in paying attention to Afro-Latinx folks.
Mm-hmm.
There's always been an interest in saying Cameron Diaz or Emilio Estevez, but there's not always been the same investment in Latino print media to sort of be attentive to Afro-Latinx actors. And also, I think right now, like, I'm really noting the fact that the Latinx media is not celebrating the success of several performers on Broadway right now who are also of Asian descent.
Right.
And so it's who are both of Latinx descent and Asian descent. And I do not see those actors being celebrated, right. Not saying you have to be Latino to these actors, but also not celebrating their success as part of the broad intersectionality that defines what Latinxness is.
Right. There is absolutely a question of, like, who are we acknowledging? And then there's also a question that I begin to see a lot of, this notion of almost like tokenization in this moment in time where people are really thinking about representation, or they are really thinking about, you know, like, diversity and, oh, well, this spot can be anyone. And I guess, you know, Victor, for you, as the casting director, you know, and talking about the vulnerability of actors and what we're asking actors to do, is I oftentimes see shows where there is a for effort attempt in more inclusive casting. However, you're led to ask the sort of dramaturgically, what are you actually asking these actors to do? What roles are you asking them to do? And questions of that, how do you navigate that as a casting director? These moments where you're like, this feels like tokenizing,
sure.
You know, where you're pulling in an actor of color, but you're not actually thinking about what that actor of color is being asked to do on that stage and what that inherently, what story that inherently is carrying and how that is inherently shaping the play.
Mm-hmm. So I was having this conversation with Brian just outside the studio right before this, but we were talking about how, you know, the role of the casting director varies depending on, you know, a lot of how it exists today. The role exists as a sort of freelance, outsourced position, right? For those few of us who are resident casting directors who do have the support of the producer, I think that we get to ask harder questions. Mm-hmm. There's a difference. There's this quote here. I just want to sort of put it out there, that there's a significant difference between all are welcome here and this was created with you in mind. And I want to highlight that quote just because I think that being supported by a producer as a casting director, or having that sort of agency, if you're part of a development process earlier on in the workshop process, right, and you get to ask those questions early on as this piece is really shaping up, then as a casting director, you really have some agency in being able to shape up,
right,
you know, and ask some hard questions about the actors, with the actors, about the characters that are being represented within the script, within the story, how we are treating the bodies in the rehearsal space. And so I advocate so much for that system to continue, if possible, that casting directors are supported by producers, mm-hmm. and that they're backed and that they share the same values, and that casting directors are given agency to participate collectively in the art making with the director and the playwright. Yeah. Because I think if you give the casting director agency, then they can also help advocate for, you know, the actors that are not present in the room.
Yeah, one of my dreams in some ways is, especially in theater, where there's a different, there's a lot more space to sort of change things, especially in educational or smaller not-for-profit theaters, is I'd love for casting professionals to be incorporated as designers are in sort of designing the show.
Absolutely.
You know, so that the first conversation of casting doesn't happen 2 weeks before rehearsal, but happens the first time a design meeting is happening. So that the casting director can begin to introduce these questions with the costumer at the beginning of their work, with the director, with the choreographer at the beginning of their work, saying, who are we thinking about here? Like, What are the principles of the bodies on the stage? Because they are, and I do think that that's one of the real failures of imagination, operational imagination in the American theater, is only thinking of casting of how can we cast this as efficiently and as cheaply and in a way that doesn't get us in trouble. That defensive stance for casting is something that can't cost us anything in terms of either actual or social capital. It leads to almost every bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, yes to the design, to the aspect of casting design, yes to the form of casting turgy, right? A sort of form of dramaturgy.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And I also want to advocate that if casting directors, if we're given that sort of agency, then we're able to really care for the system that we're participating in, right? What I mean by that is, you know, I've just begun to start asking, how do I negotiate the intimacy how do I negotiate intimacy within this mm-hmm. this role? In a recent conversation with an intimacy director, a choreographer, I was trying to unpack, you know, how do I start introducing this concept early on, even from the breakdown?
Yeah.
You know, how do you release a breakdown that really just outlines consent? Mm-hmm. This is the role that we're casting for, and these are all the aspects that are attached to this role. The role requires X, Y, Z.
And I think that that's one of the hugest interventions that folks in the who have the capacity to make changes in basic how this process is being cast, is because I do think that when actors stopped being cast for roles or for being part of an ensemble, they started getting cast to be parts, which are parts mm-hmm. in a machine. Mm-hmm. And so this kind of way where they are expected to sort of just slot in and do their part without being human. And you can see that in the most dehumanizing audition processes, where they're expected to not have consent. They're expected to sort of do whatever they're asked to do in whatever conditions they're asked to do it. Because if they don't, then they must not really want this job. And right. there's a million others yeah. right out there. And so I think that that's one of the ways where the structure is really set up for dehumanization Absolutely. Of all and for yes. folks being... like you'll often hear folks involved in casting processes saying, I hate those kind of auditions. They make me feel like a terrible person. But it's like, how do we interrupt with the operation of that machine? And the casting machinery yeah. is something that's only 100 years old.
Right.
We can redesign it, but we have to understand how it works and what benefits we get from it working the way it does.
Right.
Because that's also the key question about white supremacy and white supremacist structures in theater, is we have to be really honest when we're calling it out. We have to be very honest in that self-reflective analysis of how does it serve me too, and what are the things I'm benefiting from it, as opposed to the things I'm trying to cause for change. And so I think casting is a space where we can really, I think going back to part of what gathers people's interest about casting is it does a lot of visible change.
Absolutely.
And so some of the earliest interventions, we're going to get different people in the room, and that'll change the process.
Absolutely.
Over the last, like, I think one of the big marks of Hamilton is we said, we got all the people in the room, and actually nothing really changed. We have to get, well, who's in the room not on the stage?
Right, absolutely.
And sure. start thinking yep. about designers and start thinking about the full personnel. Like, it's really, yep. but casting is the most legible tip of an iceberg about how right. opportunities are allocated in this business.
And I mean, just looking around, there aren't enough casting directors of color. There Absolutely, aren't there yeah. aren't enough trans casting directors. There aren't enough queer POC casting directors.
There's a lot right? of consultants who get called in, often unpaid, to provide
sure.
lists.
Absolutely. But most of the casting offices in New York City are white yeah. casting
cis,
directors,
yeah.
cis casting directors, right? And so I also want to acknowledge that that is also part of the problem.
Yes, absolutely.
And because, again, the imagination cannot exist yeah. without...
And right. I think you end up seeing the similar problem where, you know, in those situations where those lists are made up of the same five names,
totally.
It's the same five artists, it's the artists who have been vetted, the artists who have been seen. And I think that goes, yeah. And it just is this continued cycle where it's like, I love that you called out the white supremacy of the system, that it's not necessarily the most overt thing in the room, but the expediency of it. It's like, this is fast. I've seen them. I know they are vetted. Boom.
I love
you know?
Them. It can be a positive.
Exactly.
Too.
Yeah. And they might be wonderful, but it prevents anything new, anyone new from getting into the room, from just having that opportunity, I think, to be seen and to be considered, you know?
Well, and that's what one of the conversations I've been most proud of recently was, I was in a conversation with an associate artistic director at a major regional theater, and they were trying to figure out how to cast a show and not get in trouble.
Yeah.
And I was able to redirect that, saying, okay, well, it sounds like you've paper cast almost the entire show, but you're not sure about this one character who is of a particular ethnicity.
Yeah.
And I said, You say you have 20 slots in New York for that day. Why not just see the entire community of that? Like,
yeah.
allocate that bucket of your resources to saying, like, I need to really learn this community. I realize I don't have a list of 20 awesome middle-aged Asian American actresses.
Yeah.
You know, so if you don't have that, then how can you allocate your limited resources to fortifying that thing so that you don't run dry at one or two on,
Absolutely.
You know, so if you don't have, and there's certain populations, like, I think a lot of us have gotten calls lately for trans women of color who are over 30.
Yeah.
And there's there's the feature of how casting is about allocation of opportunity and therefore cultivating talent and cultivating careers. And so there's those kind of questions. But then there's also ones where it's like, if you don't have a long list in your own paper casting Rolodex, that's homework for you to do.
Absolutely.
And you can do that on your own by going to see different shows, by going to look for different people, and not asking somebody over Facebook message, can you give me a list of your favorite six blanks?
Right.
Because that is a way, I think, for really people who are really trying to do the right thing, that's how you're exploiting the white supremacy of the system.
Absolutely.
Is by sort of doing the sideways intimacies of getting somebody else's list and not compensating that, and also not transforming your practice so that you have a deeper reservoir of lucidity about who the extraordinarily talented people in your world are.
And this takes time, and it takes time, right? That
that
building these lists, as you say, takes a long time, right?
And I think thinking of them not necessarily as lists, but relationships, building the relationships, you know, adding back that human layer.
And building new relationships all the time.
Always. Mm-hmm.
All across the country and the world, if possible, right? Because because actors nowadays are nomadic, right? They live all over the country. They can work anywhere. They can audition via video submission. Yeah. They you can Skype audition them. You could, you know, there's so much at play now that allows the actor to exist on such a wider field, to work in television, to work in film, to work in with audiobooks. And it's really our jobs to have an understanding of what this, you know, landscape looks like.
This is clearly a very extensive conversation, and it will continue to go on and on. In the spirit of kind of bringing this back and wrapping us up here, because now that you've mentioned the nomadicy, is that the word, of actors?
Yeah.
What do you, in both of your eyes, like, what does the future of this particular branch of the industry look like? What are you hoping to see? Where are we headed? Where do you see that we are headed at this time? And what are you hoping?
When's the next explosion coming?
The explosion piece, I'm always dreading those, because that's usually a moment of opening that leads to an immediate contraction.
Absolutely.
So it's like, but I do think what it is a matter of, how do we understand the explosion of content, and especially self-generated created content? One of the great things about the moment we're at right now is folks are able to build work that really showcases the artists they want to lean forward with in a variety of different platforms. And I know that most casting professionals I know just feel overwhelmed by the amount of things to keep track of. So how can we find ways to advocate internally within our communities to make sure, do you know this person's work? Do you know this person's name? I do think that that's where Latinx artistic communities can really not get possessive, but really be generous and expansive in boosting artists that you just need to know about this artist.
Yeah.
Just know their name, know where they are, click on them, just sort of clock that and don't wait for them to come in a glossy playbill. Clock them as they're working now, because the world is changing and content is changing, and it'd be great if we knew how to get those pipelines so that people could connect it with the opportunities that would boost their career and boost their art moving forward.
So I want to reference this TED talk that Oscar Eustace gave last year about theater and democracy, right? And he talked about in this beautiful way about the DNA of our art form, about the theater. One of the sort of questions I was leading with while watching that was, you know, through the lens of who? And for me, my sort of premise there was, are we looking at the American theater through the lens of, or through the premise of, European or Western sort of structure? And so for me, I think about the sort of creative destruction of that DNA, or the creative evolution of that DNA. And I wonder, how do we intersect it, or continue to make it intersectional? For me, what the next phase of casting looks like is really leading with, you know, having more water join the river. What does it mean for us to really be inclusive, not just in front of the table, but behind it, and then get rid of the table? you know, so I'm really excited about destroying the house that is the American theater, because so much of what we do is paint it. We paint it and we talk about EDI, and we just change the color of it. And for me, it's the structure that is inherently flawed. And so what does it look like to completely remove it and say, hey, we're building this again?
Yeah.
Molly Smith Smith, who's my boss at Artistic Director at Arena Stage, is always sort of asking the question, I think, of me in the impulse of me wanting to burn things down. And I think for me, that is the handoff that I received. Mm-hmm. Is not so much the burn it down, but make it something else.
Right.
And so I offer that up to everyone that's listening, is how can you just don't be interested in painting the house.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, steal everything and tear it down. And then build something else.
And right. One last thing is, stop accepting they're not ready. Absolutely. Stop accepting they're not ready as an excuse, saying, okay, yeah, but what do we need to do to get them ready so they can take this job right now? You know, like, what production support can be provided to a performer who might not be ready or seasoned, but absolutely, could be ready to go?
And the artists are out there.
They are.
This is not a pipeline issue. Thank you, Rachel Shafkin. Yeah. Right? We are out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It has, I mean, yeah, you have to have nerve. It do take nerve.
It do.
So I want to end on this bit. I'm always really curious to ask people this type of question. If you could give some advice, or like, if your 21-year-old self was in front of you ready, you know, going into the world, like, what would you say to them?
I would say, don't feel like I'm old, but so my 21-year-old self was told by the industry I had to choose between being an actor, a director, and a writer. I had to choose whether or not I wanted to lead with this aspect of my identity or that aspect of my identity. And I would say that historical moment is no more in some ways. Do you figure out exactly who you are and how all of those parts of you fit into the kind of art you want to make and the kind of community you want to make art with and for.
I would tell my young version of myself that theater is one form of storytelling, and there are many, and that it's okay to expand the imagination beyond this form as well. And I would say that, you know, be interested, be curious, be inventive to see how television and theater can coexist, as opposed to being afraid of this intersection. How can we emerge together? I think playwrights are doing that so wisely with working in television and working as playwrights. Mm-hmm. And I think that directors can be doing that too. And I think producers can be doing that. And I just think that there's these two things that can go hand in hand. And I just want more people, a younger version of myself, to help hold those two hands together.
And I will say, as a historian, that is the tradition of Latinx performance making. The tradition of Latinx performance making has been crossing genres, crossing roles, and crossing communities. And so by doing so, you'll be joining a great tradition of Latinx art making.
That's me snapping.
Amazing.
Amazing. Yes. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for this exciting conversation.
Thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate you taking the time to come and talk.
Thanks, Sol. Thanks for having us.
It was really appreciated. It was great. Great. Thanks for letting us geek out on this stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Adios.
All right, we're back. We just finished having our conversation with Brian Herrera and Victor Vasquez. How are we feeling, David?
Great. I mean, I think, you know, what a fantastic combination of both scholar and practice. And I think just the idea of really questioning, looking back into the history of casting, how as a relatively new field it was shaped and why, and sort of rethinking. Like, I just keep thinking about Victor and, you know, get rid of the table, and like, why is there a table? You know, as a director, you know, I'm in a lot of casting rooms, and I've actually was told once, "You're so nice. Why are you so nice? You should be meaner when they come in." And I was like, why? You know, yeah. I was like, but there was that idea of like, you should make sure that they know you're in charge. And I was like, I'm the director. They know I'm in charge. You know what I mean? But like, also like, am I in charge? No one's in charge, you know? But it was just like, really that like, oh, there is an idea on the other side of the table of a protocol that has sort of been inherited. And I love this idea of questioning why. And as a director, I'm like, no, I want to create the most wonderful, inviting room.
Yeah.
I want this person to get the part. You know what I mean? Yes. It makes my job easier, you know, and sort of really centering the artist and thinking about that just in terms of how it's been structured, why it's been structured, and, you know, really giving artists and producers and casting directors the power and the agency to rethink those processes, because those processes aren't set in any kind of stone.
Yeah, and I think this...
First of all, I think that the idea of power is like almost this illusion, like the you know how you're saying that people were commenting on how apparently nice you were when you were just like being respectful.
Nice, I wasn't apparent.
Well, I mean, but like kidding. In the sense of like, you know, in comparison to what they're probably used to.
Yeah.
But that to me signals, you know, is like this. They're feeding into a power play.
Absolutely.
And that's again, like how Brian was talking about the dehumanization of the
Absolutely,
person
yeah.
coming into the room. And like, why is that? And why do people feel so attached to that? You
yeah.
know, why do they need to feel that? Like, that's a huge ego thing. And
yeah.
I don't know, it's so problematic. And again, like, how do you deconstruct that and create a new foundation to where like everybody understands that everyone holds a piece to the puzzle and we're all just trying to figure out what that picture looks
Absolutely.
Like.
And I love, you know, I mean, Victor challenging us to think about how do we get rid of that power. And I think, you know, to Brian's point, like, is it ever really possible to get rid of the power? You know, I don't know that as long as a casting process exists, I think there will always be an inherent power dynamic in it. But I do wonder that question of how can we be as transparent as possible about those power dynamics and try to really center the artists who are coming into the room to be their most vulnerable selves and take care of that and them really more so than thinking about taking care of those of us on the other side of the table and our need for some kind of a power trip, you know?
Yeah, it's a responsibility. And I think, you know, this the word accountability, the action of accountability is something that's been hovering in my mind as of recent, like just really at the forefront of, you know, being able to have those people around you that you trust that can hold you accountable for and to be able to like call you in and call you out when need be. One thing that Victor brought up in the conversation that's also at the forefront of my mind right now is people having issues with casting trans folks. And I've actually just recently binged another podcast called Topics Include. I don't know if you're familiar, but all four of the co-hosts are people of trans experience. E. Anfield Stewart, L. Morgan Lee, maybe Burke and Sammy. They this is something that they're all performers and they're constantly talking about that. And three of them are people of color as well. And the intersection of trans identity with being a person of color and how cis people are still being cast into trans roles.
Absolutely.
And
there's no reciprocity either. I think in that situation, you know, that you're not seeing trans actors cast in cis roles. And why not? You know?
Yeah. And it's definitely, you know, we just had this like robust conversation that was so enlightening. Like you said, the having scholarship and practice like kind of convene together like this was so enriching. But again, the conversation continues and hopefully like we were able to shed some light on some things for people to continue having conversations about.
Absolutely. And rethink about their practices. And, you know, I feel the call to action. And excited to rethink about, you know, the next time I'm in a casting room, just questioning how that process is. And I think the act and the art of questioning, it doesn't cost anything, you know, it's free. So you might as well ask those questions to really be intentional about your practice. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, thank you all so much for tuning in and listening for this month's episode of Soul Talk. If you'd like to continue to stay updated with the Soul Project, our website is www.soulproject.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Soul Project and at Soul Project NYC on Instagram and Twitter. Find out anything you want to plug, anything coming up for you?
Fun summer of development, you know, lots of work. We're seeing a lot of exciting Latinx artists getting their moment, you know, as playwrights out there. So I'm excited about the next season and to see who else's work we're going to get to know and see.
Amazing. Yeah. And it is summer. So if you're feeling burnt out, take some time to rest.
Yes.
Time to yourself and just relish in some peace.
Yes.
Offering that up and reminding people to do that. Some self-care is really important.
Absolutely. And remember, everybody is a summer body. So get out there and live your best life.
Great. Until next time. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you all for joining us for today's episode. Make sure you follow Soul Project on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. On Instagram and Twitter, we are at Soul Project NYC and The Soul Project on Facebook. Our website is www.soulproject.org.